You are in the middle of a busy emergency shift when you see your next patient, Ms. Richardson, a 37-year-old woman who was the victim of a gunshot wound to the chest after being robbed. On arrival, her blood pressure is only 80 over 60, heart rate is 110 beats per minute, and respiratory rate 22 breaths per minute. Her neck veins are distended and her heart sounds are muffled. As you consider these findings, what diagnosis are you most concerned about? And what could be done immediately to assist this patient? Consider your answers as we begin this next episode. Welcome to AudioBricks. I'm Adam Weinstein, bringing cardiology from our bricks to your ears. After completing this brick, you will be able to 1. Define pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade and describe the relevant anatomy. 2. Compare and contrast the clinical presentations of pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade. 3. List the common causes of pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade. 4. Explain how pericardial effusion can lead to cardiac tamponade. 5. Discuss how to confirm the diagnosis of pericardial effusions and cardiac tamponade, including the physical exam, electrocardiogram findings, and radiologic findings. And 6, describe the management of pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade. Part 1, what is a pericardial effusion and what is cardiac tamponade? The pericardial space normally contains up to 50 milliliters of serous fluid, just enough to lubricate the layers of pericardium as the heart beats and moves around in the chest. When infection, trauma, or other insults cause the amount of pericardial fluid to increase, it results in a pericardial effusion. Small effusions do not typically produce symptoms. However, very large effusions may contain more than 2,000 milliliters of fluid and start compressing the heart and interfering with its ability to pump blood. This is called cardiac tamponade. Cardiac tamponade is a medical emergency, and if left untreated, can progress to cardiogenic shock and death. Before delving into more detail on these serious problems, let's review the pericardial anatomy. The pericardium of the heart consists of 3 layers. From outer to inner, the layers are the fibrous pericardium, the parietal layer of serous pericardium, and the visceral layer of serous pericardium. The pericardial cavity, or space, is located between the parietal and visceral layers of the serous pericardium. This is the space that normally contains a small amount of fluid that reduces friction within the pericardium during the contraction and relaxation of the heart. Before we talk about common clinical presentations of these effusions, let's pause for a question break. What is the name of the condition in which a large pericardial effusion compresses the heart and leads to hemodynamic compromise and can lead to shock? If you said cardiac tamponade, you are correct. Part 2. How do patients with pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade present? As we discussed, most patients with a small pericardial effusion will not have symptoms specific to the effusion. Such effusions are often diagnosed incidentally during the evaluation of other symptoms, such as fever or weight loss. However, patients with larger effusions may present with cardiac tamponade, and these patients do have signs and symptoms of hemodynamic compromise. Their heart rate will be high and blood pressure might be low. Their jugular veins may become dilated because the heart is unable to pump the blood in a forward direction. Patients may also complain of signs of impaired end organ perfusion, such as dizziness and fatigue when the brain is not getting enough blood. Part 3. What is the pathophysiology for pericardial effusions and cardiac tamponade? Pericardial effusions and cardiac tamponade result from any process that leads to fluid buildup in the pericardial space. Examples of such processes include acute pericarditis, congestive heart failure, hypoalbuminemia, and cardiac rupture. In acute pericarditis, for example, from a viral infection or autoimmune disease, the pericardial inflammation leads to increased capillary permeability, resulting in the effusion. Whereas with congestive heart failure, the increased hydrostatic pressure causes fluid to move from the blood into the interstitial space, including the pericardial space. Similarly, the decreased plasma oncotic pressure caused by hypoalbuminemia, for example, with nephrotic syndrome or liver failure, results in fluid moving from the blood into the interstitial space, including the pericardial space. Malignancy may result in a pericardial effusion related to metastatic spread into the pericardium. This is called a malignant effusion. And lastly, cardiac rupture, for example, from myocardial infarction or penetrating trauma, may lead to hemorrhage into the pericardial space and a hemorrhagic effusion or hemopericardium. The causes of cardiac tamponade are the same as those for pericardial effusion. The effusion is just more severe, and the high volume compresses and compromises a cardiac function, hence the term tamponade, which means compression. So how much fluid is needed for cardiac tamponade to occur? Well, it's different for everyone. It occurs when the accumulation of fluid within the pericardial cavity is large enough and has developed rapidly enough to increase the pericardial space pressure to an extent that impedes the expansion and diastolic filling of the cardiac chambers. When the pressure inside the pericardium elevates, it will first compromise the right atrium and right ventricle, the low pressure chambers. Compression of the right heart chambers decreases venous return to the heart and therefore decreases left ventricular preload, cardiac output, and blood pressure. As I just implied, the speed of fluid accumulation will also determine the severity of the patient presentation and whether cardiac tamponade will develop. Slow, chronic fluid accumulation in the pericardium allows for the gradual stretching of the pericardium to accommodate more fluid, so a slow process creates less of an urgent problem. On the other hand, rapid accumulation of fluid, as in trauma-mediated hemopericardium, will more often cause more severe signs and symptoms. And now for a question break. Compression of which cardiac chambers plays the biggest role in the development of complications in cardiac tamponade? Compression of the right atrium and right ventricle leads to reduced filling of the heart and reduced left ventricular preload, reducing cardiac output. Part 4. How do we diagnose pericardial effusions and cardiac tamponade? As I've been emphasizing, small pericardial effusions do not typically produce symptoms in and of themselves and are often discovered incidentally. In contrast, large pericardial effusions may cause cardiac tamponade, which leads to signs and symptoms of hemodynamic compromise. Similarly, pericardial effusions that haven't progressed to cardiac tamponade usually have few or no physical exam findings, though the underlying diseases causing them may have findings, the small effusions do not. On the other hand, patients with cardiac tamponade may present with elements of the Beck triad on physical exam. The Beck triad consists of jugular venous distension, muffled heart sounds, and hypotension. This sounds a lot like our patient. Note that although the occurrence of all three signs simultaneously is uncommon, it is important to consider each of them when we are suspicious of tamponade. Additional physical exam signs that patients with cardiac tamponade may demonstrate include tachycardia, tachypnea, and pulsus paradoxus. Pulsus paradoxus is defined as a decrease in systolic blood pressure by greater than 10 millimeters of mercury during inspiration. Pulsus paradoxus may also be present in asthma, obstructive sleep apnea, constrictive pericarditis, and croup. Why is this finding present? To answer that, let's first think about what happens to blood flow with respiration under normal conditions. When we take a deep breath in, intrathoracic pressure drops, which increases venous return. With increased venous return, the right side of the heart expands to accommodate this increased volume. Now let's think about the same parameters when cardiac tamponade is present. Although the venous return has increased during inspiration, the right side of the heart is unable to expand to accommodate the extra blood because the pressure in the pericardial space is too high. The only mobility is from the intraventricular septum, which is forced to shift toward the left. This decreases the size of the left ventricle and therefore decreases its stroke volume, leading to reduced cardiac output. The reduction in cardiac output drops the systolic blood pressure during inspiration. That's interesting stuff. Let's pause for a question. What are the three physical exam features of Beck triad that should be assessed for when there is suspicion of cardiac tamponade? Jugular venous distension, muffled heart sounds, and hypotension. In addition to history and physical exam, Diagnostic testing with electrocardiography, chest x-ray, and echocardiography are typically helpful in diagnosis of a pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade. Patients with pericardial effusion, with or without cardiac tamponade, may show a number of findings on their electrocardiogram. The most specific and striking finding is called electrical alternans, a beat-to-beat variation in the QRS complex amplitude. That is, the QRS complexes alternate between being low voltage and being high voltage. This sign is produced by the swinging movement of the heart in the fluid-filled pericardial sac. However, it's only seen in a minority of patients with tamponade, around 20 to 25% of patients. More common, though less specific, includes sinus tachycardia and low voltage QRS complexes in all leads. The latter occurs because the fluid around the heart limits electric conduction to the EKG leads. A chest x-ray of a patient with pericardial effusion may reveal an enlarged heart with a water bottle shape. Note that to be detected by chest x-ray, at least 250 milliliters of fluid must be present in the pericardial cavity, and so smaller effusions would generally go unnoticed. The diagnosis of pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade is typically established on echocardiogram. Apart from confirming the presence or absence of a pericardial effusion, an echocardiogram can also detect the pathophysiologic features of cardiac tamponade, including impaired diastolic filling of the right-sided chambers. A pericardial effusion may also be found during a FAST examination, which stands for a focused assessment by sonography for trauma. Okay, let's sum all that up with a question. What is the preferred imaging modality to establish the diagnosis of pericardial effusion and the diagnosis of cardiac tamponade? That would be echocardiography. Part 5, how do we manage pericardial effusions and cardiac tamponade? If a patient with pericardial effusion is hemodynamically stable, with no evidence of cardiac tamponade, it is not necessary to drain the effusion or provide any intervention specific to the effusion itself. Rather, treatment is directed to the underlying condition, for example, antibiotics for infection. In patients with cardiac tamponade and hemodynamic compromise, emergent drainage of the pericardial effusion is needed. This is achieved through a pericardiocentesis, which involves the removal of fluid from the pericardial space via percutaneous needle aspiration. The removed pericardial fluid is then sent to the lab for analysis, for example, the assessment of white blood cell and red blood cell counts and cultures, which can provide information about the specific cause of the pericardial effusion. Additionally, placement of a pericardial window involves the excision of part of the pericardium to allow for continuous drainage of the pericardial sac after pericardiocentesis. Let's review one more time with a question. What is the treatment of choice for a cardiac tamponade? Pericardiocentesis is the treatment of choice for cardiac tamponade. And that's all I have today for pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade. Let's see if we've completed our goals for this episode. First, can you define pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade? Pericardial effusion is a pathologic accumulation of fluid within the pericardial space. Cardiac tamponade occurs when the accumulation of fluid within the pericardial cavity becomes so significant that the chambers of the heart are no longer able to properly expand, impairing the heart's ability to pump blood efficiently. Next, can you compare and contrast the clinical presentations of pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade? Pericardial effusions that are not hemodynamically significant are often asymptomatic. Cardiac tamponade presents with signs of hemodynamic compromise, such as hypotension and tachycardia. Third, can you list the common causes of pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade? Causes causes of pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade include acute pericarditis, congestive heart failure, nephrotic syndrome, liver failure, malignancy, cardiac rupture, and also aortic dissection. Moving on, can you explain how pericardial effusion can lead to cardiac tamponade? Compression of the cardiac chambers reduces right atrial and ventricular size, reducing preload and left ventricular stroke volume. Now, can you discuss how to confirm the diagnosis of pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade, including on physical exam, electrocardiogram, and radiologic findings? Physical exam is nonspecific in small pericardial effusions, but cardiac tamponade may show elements of the Beck triad, jugular venous distension, muffled heart sounds, and hypotension, as well as tachypnea, tachycardia, and pulsus paradoxus. Electrocardiogram may demonstrate sinus tachycardia, low voltage QRS complexes, or electric alternans. And echocardiography is the best test to confirm a pericardial effusion. And lastly, can you describe the management of pericardial effusion and cardiac tamponade? Patients with small pericardial effusions who are hemodynamically stable do not need drainage or management specific to the effusion and can be treated for their underlying condition. Patients with evidence of hemodynamic compromise and cardiac tamponade should undergo emergent pericardiocentesis to drain the pericardial effusion. A pericardial window may also be placed to allow for continuous drainage of the pericardial sac in recurring effusions. Armed with your newfound knowledge of pericardial effusions and cardiac tamponade, let's revisit our patient's story from the beginning of this episode. Thinking back to Miss Richardson, she presented after a gunshot wound to the chest with a blood pressure of 80 over 60, heart rate of 110, and respiratory rate of 22. Her neck veins were distended and her heart sounds were muffled. As you consider these findings, what diagnosis are you most concerned about and what could be done immediately to assist her? Ms. Richardson is demonstrating the findings of the Beck triad on her physical exam, and given her mechanism of injury, cardiac tamponade is strongly suspected. A bedside echocardiogram confirms the diagnosis and assists with emergent pericardiocentesis. She has a complicated clinical course ahead of her, and this was the very necessary first step to her management. And that's all I have for today's audio break. Thanks for joining me. If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up or a comment. You can enjoy the full Brick experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. Stay healthy out there.